Welcome to another open and another show, a musical theatre podcast with Jane F and
Jane S.
We are both lovers of musical theatre. I'm a lifelong lover from many, many generations of opera and straight plays and musicals in my family. And Jane S?
I have a much shorter history with musical theatre and defer to Jane F as the doyen of musical theatre. I'm here as her trusty sidekick.
But this week, you're going to be driving the conversation.
Which is terrifying for everybody involved, yes.
Now, one thing we'll tell you, dear listener, is that due to copyright restrictions, we can't actually play you the music of the show that goes with what we're talking about.
Jane, this is devastating news. Why? Tell us more.
Because the people who wrote the music would like to get money every time somebody listens to it. And the Gawler Broadcasting Association has decided not to apply for the incredibly expensive license. So we have created a Spotify playlist for our listeners' pleasure to go and click on before or after this and have a little listen to so you know what we're talking about.
Love that.
Yeah. It's very exciting making that playlist. Copyright is for the protection of the composers, usually.
Sure.
And say if you're David Henniker, who wrote Half a Sixpence and Charlie Girl, which some listeners may still remember the existence thereof. He did not become Andrew Lloyd Webber or Stephen Sondheim level of fame and money. So he deserves, or probably his children now, to get the money for whenever some little group does Half a Sixpence. Lloyd Webber, the Rodgers and Hammersteins, Disney, eh. But those characters do have a very hefty legal team who will come and find you. So please click on our Spotify link and enjoy listening through the legal, although the composers don't get any money really, means of Spotify. You may also Google.
Yes, don't tell it. We're certainly not advocating for anybody to do anything naughty.
Great. Definitely not.
And welcome to another opening, another show, the podcast. This week we're going to be speaking about Company, the musical. Hello to you, Jane.
Hello, Jane. It's lovely to be here again. It's lovely to be downstairs in the cellars of the Gawler Civic Centre in our deluxe studio.
I love it.
Where
it
is 22 degrees, as opposed to upstairs where it is 40.
Yes. Look, anywhere you can go that is not 40 degrees, I say let's go there.
Yes, and for our international listener, that is a centigrade, not a Fahrenheit.
Oh, yes. This is proper hot.
Yes, we do it. We do it here on Kaurna land in South Australia. The heat. That's what we do.
Yeah.
So, Jane, what has your research shown us about Company?
Sure. Thanks, Jane. So, I didn't know a lot about Company before I started researching, which won't surprise anyone. I know very little about a lot of musicals. This particular one was written, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, with a book by George Firth. George Firth was a playwright prior to this production coming into existence, and he had written 11 one-act plays in the late 1960s for an actress named Kim Stanley. She was the narrator in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh.
So it came out of 11 one-act plays. Anthony Perkins was touted to direct, and he originally showed these 11 one-act plays to Stephen Sondheim, who then spoke to a producer by the name of Harold Prince, who thought that combining the stories together might work well as a musical. Turns out he was right. So the plays, as they were, all featured a different outsider character, which they felt could be merged and create one lead character, and that became Robert in the musical. So initially, that was 11 different people merged into one. The play was very modern, looked at relationships in the new world of dating in the 1970s in New York, and it's a concept musical, which features a series of vignettes rather than following a linear plot line. It was first performed in Boston in 1970 in out-of-town tryouts and then opened on Broadway in April 1970 and ran until January 1972.
Which
is a pretty good opening run, especially when the out-of-town tryouts were mixed.
Interesting. And we're now used to these decade-long runs from Phantom and things, but this is a very small show.
Correct.
It has a set.
Yeah.
No flying chandeliers or helicopters and no dancing girls. There's not even dancing. The original choreographer was billed as musical items staged by Michael Bennett.
Wow. Okay.
Because it's more your moving of actors to the music.
Yes.
There's nobody with dance training required.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, the set in some productions has been nothing much more than a couple of chairs. So it is absolutely not a giant spectacular.
Yeah.
Like, you're right, like we're used to with things like Phantom of the Opera.
So then it's the strength of writing that propelled it for these 2-year run.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
The characters are considered by many people to be very realistic, as you were just saying. It's the strength of those characters and the strong songs and the good writing that has allowed the show to travel as well as it has, to be as popular as it has. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about one of the actors who was cast in the first Broadway production. So his name was Dean Jones. He was originally cast to replace Anthony Perkins, who left quite early on in rehearsals. Dean Jones then left the show in May 1970, so only a few weeks after opening night, and he was replaced by a man named Larry Kent, who was his understudy.
Right.
Larry Kent then went on to be nominated for a Tony for Best Actor in a Musical for this performance, which...
Wow.
Yeah. In my research showed that it's something that's really very rare, and normally only the actor who starts in the role is considered to be...
Yes. They would have had to actually have had some kind of an extraordinary general meeting at the Tony board.
I suspect they probably did. Yeah, absolutely. He didn't go on to win, but it obviously says a lot about his performance and probably a little bit about the strength of the characters and the story that is behind it.
Now, with Dean Jones, do you know where you recognise him from? Have you seen his photo?
Do you know what? When I saw the name Dean Jones, my first thought was, isn't he a cricketer? And I'm like, no, that's not the Dean Jones.
No, this one. Most famously known to us as the guy in Herbie the Love Bug movies. Yeah, and he pulled out because this was all too real for him. His marriage was breaking down at the time, and he didn't really need to be surrounded by people talking about relationships.
No.
Or badly working relationships, a lot of these.
I think that's more to the point. There was a quote, which I haven't written down, but a quote in his autobiography that was something along the lines of, this show shows marriage not in its best light. Words to that effect. He's obviously a lot more verbose in that than me. The relationships in this show and his own marriage falling apart or coming to pieces, he had to step aside. It was too much.
Yeah, absolutely.
The show has been produced a number of times all around the world since 1970. Straight after that Broadway run in 1970, it went to the West End, and a number of the Broadway cast were called upon to reprise their roles for that. It came to Australia. The Sydney Theatre Company put on a production of it in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
There have been reunion concerts which have featured the original Broadway cast for charity in the USA. And in 1995, Sondheim and Firth got together to rewrite some of the show that hadn't aged particularly well, didn't work quite so well 20-something years on. And they also introduced a new song, which was Marry Me a Little.
Right.
The show has been translated into other languages, such as Slovenian, Polish, Swedish, been put on in Singapore, all over the place. There's a couple of versions of the show, so there's a couple of little facts for you.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007, an Australian production was on in Sydney.
Yes.
And Christine Whelan, who played Amy, was sick for a performance.
Right.
So the chief executive, rather than cancelling the show and refunding people's money or advising the audience what was going on, said the show would go ahead without her. They cut scenes, they cut songs, and nothing was explained to the audience, and the show was 20 minutes shorter than it normally would have been.
How peculiar.
How peculiar indeed. It received a lot of bad press. Shocking. And Sondheim actually threatened to cancel the rights or revoke the rights to the show. As a result of the bad press.
See, I was going to say, I know some people who flew from Adelaide to Sydney just to see that version of Company. Imagine if that was the one that they'd spent all that money on getting there and staying to see.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I think, any performance, anything can go wrong at any time. That's the excitement of live theatre. And audiences are very understanding. If you say at the start someone's sick and we've had to make an adjustment, I can't see it.
And did we not have any funding for a female understudy?
Look, there was no mention of anyone being available for it, so who knows? Who knows?
I suppose it's doable to a degree.
Mm.
Who was she? April?
Amy.
Amy. Oh, they're not getting married today, girl.
Yeah.
Oh. I was going to say, because it's vignettes.
Yes.
You just...
That's exactly
But
right.
Does that mean that Amy's husband and all his bits got chucked?
Look, I don't know. And he just sat backstage? Possibly, because it wasn't. It did say a number of her scenes. So there wasn't a mention in the research that I did that said they reworked anything on the spot. They just chopped them.
Wow. Yeah.
Interesting.
Poor Christy.
Yeah, yeah.
She had a bit of a rough drop. I'll talk about that in another thing.
Okay. So there was a version of the show that they workshopped in 2013, not in Australia. It was an all-male cast, but Sondheim actually ended up not approving it beyond that workshop stage, saying that it didn't work because it wasn't written that way. He has said in the past that the character is not gay, and an all-male cast, they would have had to play it that way.
Yes. So, there was also rumours in 2010 of a movie going to be made, and the person who'd been attached to scriptwriter wanted to make Bobby gay, and Sondheim just went, no.
Yeah.
That doesn't work. That's not what this story is. He's not unable to marry women because of that.
No.
It's because he's unable to commit. He's got lots of emotional issues. That is what this is about. Yes. It's not about gayness.
It's not about being gay. And yes, I think so. And I think too, because there was a gender swapping version that they did in London in 2018. Jonathan Bailey, who I think
was Fierro
in the whole world forever or whatever it was. He was in it. Patti LuPone won an Olivier Award. Yes. She was in it. And Sondheim was actually really impressed with the gender swapping interpretation. And he said after seeing it that he thought Firth would have loved it too. So he was
thought was put into it. It wasn't just let's swap Bobby for a Bobby, i.e.
No.
They changed Amy into a man. Correct. I think that's probably Jonathan Bailey's part. Absolutely. So that's not getting married today.
Yep.
Became a gay marriage because that had only been legal in England for a little while.
Yeah.
And then the trio, You Could Drive a Person Crazy, slight copyright, walking the line there. They were all men, of course, because they were three suitors of Bobby.
Mm.
But it made sense. And then Joanne was still Joanne because that character has to be a woman of that age and that era. And Miss LuPone is the next best thing to Stretch.
Yeah. Yeah, deserved her award. Absolutely. The last note that I have made here, as you said, there was talk of a movie, and William Goldman, who wrote Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, amongst
Manila.
He was approached to write it, but Sondheim was then talked out of it, and the film has never materialised.
I don't think it needs to. I think it's a theatre work.
Yeah.
There are some that just, well, it's a series of vignettes, so what are we going to just have? Six different lounge rooms.
A film made of short stories.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, maybe it'll work, but
yeah. It would actually be better on Netflix's TV.
Ooh, as a series.
As these little things that you tune into.
Yes.
But not a movie. It's intimate.
Yeah.
And conceptual, as we said.
Absolutely.
So you need people to altogether take a leap with you. You don't really want it set in reality.
Yeah. And that's very hard to do. There wraps up my investigation into Company the Musical.
Thank you, Jane.
Pleasure, Jane. Stay tuned to hear from our special guest who has a special personal connection with today's show.
Comedy is about all the same things, but the synopsis is going to be the 1996 version, which is the licensable version. So if you were to see it at any point from now, this is the synopsis.
Right.
There are some slight changes. That film that was in cinemas 15 years ago with Neil Patrick Harris playing Bobby, that was actually the original. So
the 70s version.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And they uber-70-fied it. Stephen Colbert was in a lovely turtleneck jumper.
I was going to say, it was everything orange and brown.
Yes,
and everyone was in flares. Lovely.
Or cords.
Oh, or corded flares.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. It was lovely. Apart from Joanne, who tended to just look like you imagine she always does, which is just a black cocktail dress type thing. This is the revised, licensable version, first staged in London in 1996, differing in several ways from the original 1970 Broadway show.
Sure.
I recently listened to a podcast of two directors who have done it on Broadway, and Raul Esparza, who played Bobby in, I think that was 2013, maybe. And it was just around the occasion of Sondheim's 90th birthday when there were lots of chats about Sondheim stuff. One of the directors said that he directed this new version He had seen the old one several times and couldn't actually pinpoint what the changes were.
Right,
so
okay.
If someone who knows this work so intimately didn't really notice, they're not major. There are some lyrics that got changed.
Sure.
In, I think it's in You Can Drive a Person Crazy, there's a rhyme with bag that then rhymes with, and if he happens to be a F slur.
Right, sure.
We don't like that.
Mm.
It was obviously in casual speech in the 70s when it was written.
Sure.
And the lyrics were written by a gay man. Now, I don't know whether he was saying that that character is unthinking and using nasty language, or was it more just colloquial and acceptable.
Okay.
So that has been changed to suit our tastes as audiences these days.
Nice.
Because it's unnecessary.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sondheim is cleverer than that. He can find another couplet. So, and he did. Act One. Company, a 1970 concept musical, was based on a series of 11 one-act plays by George Firth, who then wrote the book of the musical, as Jane said earlier. It was originally intended as a star vehicle for that actress Kim Hunter. Now, what was she in?
She was the narrator in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, so she was the voice of Scout.
But, look, I'm sure if you were to look her up on Wikipedia or some such page, she would have a discography, filmography a million miles long.
Oh, and stage work, presumably.
Absolutely. But that was the common cultural reference that I thought people would know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Robert, Bobby or Bob, and that's important. Different friends call him by different diminutives or his full name, and it indicates the level of their friendship. He is alone, listening to his friend's miscellaneous 35th birthday greetings on his answering machine. There are five couples, Joanne and Larry, Susan and Peter, Amy and Paul, Sarah and Harry, and Jenny and David, who gather to surprise him. A birthday cake with lit candles appears. He blows out half the candles and doesn't wish for anything. The couples retreat to their apartment spaces. More musical busy signals are heard as the couple and his girlfriends, Marta, Kathy and April, call and speak varied versions of his name. Robert sings about his married friends in company, and then they all sing. By the end of it, they're all there in his mind singing, I feel.
Right.
Been a long time since I saw it, but that's how it comes across in the recording to me. And we begin to see them in their everyday settings, with him visiting the third wheel indeed.
So with him as the third wheel, that does ring true from what I'd read about those 11 one-act plays. Each of them had an outsider that they then combined into Robert. So the fact, or Bobby, or Bob. So the fact that he is that third wheel, perfect.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense.
Robert has dined with Sarah and Harry. When making Robert a drink, Harry claims to have been on the wagon for a year and a half. Sarah corrects him. She offers Robert a brownie, claiming to be on a diet. Harry sneaks a drink. Sarah secretively devours a brownie. So we're both hiding things and making Robert be
the witness to the naughtiness. Yeah, okay.
They bicker and Harry urges Sarah to demonstrate a karate move she has learnt. She is reticent, but Robert encourages her and Harry and Sarah tangle, throwing each other to the floor. Finally, Sarah pins Harry down. Joanne appears and sings ironically about marriage and relationships in The Little Things You Do Together. Love that song.
Yeah.
In the aftermath of the wrestling, all three end up on the floor, not including Joanne. That's a badly worded sentence on my part. Sorry. As the other couples join Joanne's song, the fight ends in a draw. Sarah sneaks another brownie as Harry steals another drink. Robert asks Harry if he's ever regretted being married. Harry, David and Larry describe their feelings about marriage with sorry, grateful. A very interesting and not always pleasing to the 1970 audience, exposition of men's emotions on the stage.
Ooh, interesting.
Mm. God, that was a bit of critical backlash.
Wow, I would have thought that of all people, a theatre audience would have been welcoming to see emotions from anyone. That's interesting.
Mm.
Yeah, okay.
Because everyone had been very strong
Yeah, okay.
Previously, you know, we've got Camelot leading up to that.
Yeah.
Probably Tevye would have been the most in touch with his emotions of any leading man on Broadway in the big shows up to that point.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
Mm, yeah.
How far we've come.
I know. If you don't have emotions, it's not much of a show.
Correct. Yeah.
Visiting Peter and Susan. Bobby jokingly says he wants to be the first to know if the happily married couple ever breaks up. They startle him by announcing their divorce, but explain they intend to continue living together. That's a very modern thing.
That is extraordinary. Yeah.
Mm. At Jenny and David's apartment, they are smoking marijuana.
Oh, hello.
Mm. They're apparently quite used to that.
Right, okay.
Oh, the boys are. It is Jenny's first time and she says she doesn't feel it. They're all getting high and Jenny uncharacteristically swears at the neighbour who's telling them to be quiet.
Right.
Yeah, she can't
she
feel
doesn't
it.
Feel it.
Apparently.
But, yeah, okay.
Mm. She asks Robert when he plans to get married. Saying he's not avoiding marriage, he claims he simply hasn't picked a time or a partner.
Sure.
So it's the first time I think someone's asked him flat out.
Yeah.
Then Robert's three girlfriends, Marta, Kathy, and April, appear and sing about their frustrations with You Could Drive a Person Crazy. That's my favourite song in the thing because it harks back to a previous era, which is my favourite era.
Okay, right.
But it's also very clever.
Okay.
Back with Jenny and David, another joint is offered, but David declines and tells Jenny to do the same, informing Robert that she's too square to be smoking pot.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. So he tells Jenny.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That might be why they're on about to be divorced.
Yeah, yeah.
Several of the married men tell Robert about women they could set him up with, when have I got a girl for you? And they ask, what do you want to get married for? When he could have physical satisfaction without emotional entanglement.
Sure.
Bobby sings about finding a woman who combines the best qualities of all the married women. And his song, Someone Is Waiting.
Right.
So a bit like Jenny, a bit like so-and-so, and a bit like the other, Will.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah, sure she does. Sitting on a park bench, Bobby is visited by Marta, who sings about New York as the city full of strangers, with another 100 people just got off of the train. April, a sweetly naive flight attendant, appears and apologises for being boring.
Oh.
Now, she's not stupid. Sometimes she is played as just completely vapid.
Sure.
She's not the cleverest, but she has great emotional intelligence, and that's why a bit of her and a bit of the other, they all suit him certain bits. Kathy enters and tells Bobby she's moving to Vermont to get married since he never proposed.
Okay.
Marta finishes her song and explains her eccentric views about life in New York. So we've got Marta who loves New York,
right,
but Kathy who's fed up with New York and fed up with him and wants moves to the country to do the marriage thing.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably going to be a lot more satisfied. On the morning of Paul and Amy's wedding day, Robert is the best man.
Right.
Amy is panicking. A woman in a choir robe sings about the blessings of weddings and Paul chimes in. But Amy frantically announces that she's not getting married today. She tearfully tells Paul she simply can't. Visibly upset, he leaves.
Of course. You would.
Yeah.
I would. Yes.
It's an absolute tour de force of a song. It's very much like a Gilbert and Sullivan patter song. And she's a million miles an hour and has to be really spot on, really clear.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. And emotional.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful.
Robert abruptly asks Amy to marry him.
Right, sure. As you do. Why not? Yep. Great.
But she turns him down, realizing how ridiculous she has recently been in light of Bobby being even more ridiculous, and she realizes that what she has with Paul is worth going for.
Okay.
So they do get married.
Right. So a little bit of perhaps cold feet.
Yes, yeah, just a panic attack, really.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and why not? You know.
It's a big deal. I get it. Good on you, Amy.
Well,
yeah.
Marriage is a big deal. People overblow weddings.
Oh.
No, yeah. We don't know her history with all the mothers.
Sure.
So we couldn't all have...
Just the dress is enough. You don't need mothers. Oh, my God. Yeah, okay.
Dear listener, I have a backstory. My mother was pressured into the wedding of the century by the mother of the groom, not even the mother of the bride.
Right.
And therefore, I was allowed to do whatever I pleased.
Lovely.
And I had one attendant and 32 guests and spent time with each of the guests at the reception. It was delightful and relaxing. And it was still a proper wedding.
Yeah, of course.
Poor Amy probably didn't get that privilege and had a little bit of a breakdown that morning.
Yep.
Fair enough. And then this other guy says, do you want to marry me instead?
You've already got the dress. We're ready to go. Come on. Like,
yeah. And then she went, oh, no, you're nuts.
Yeah.
Robert yearns for connection but is not ready for a full commitment. And that's when he's singing Marry Me a Little, that new song. Back in his apartment, the guests are again present and Amy enters with the birthday cake. End of act one.
Oh, off to get some chips and popcorn. Lovely.
Yes. And if you're not in Australia, you're allowed to take it inside the theatre and rustle for the whole of act two.
Oh, that'd be lovely for everyone around you. Rustle.
Particularly people who've flown from the other side of the world to be in the West End. That's right. Sidebar there, people.
Shake it off, Jane. Shake it off. It's okay. Oh,
yeah, that only happened to me 20 years ago and I haven't got over it. Don't forget to stick around while our special guest reveals the next show behind the door. Okay, act two. It's still Bobby's birthday and the cake is still there. He blows out most of the candles again, still not making a wish, and the wives finish the task for him. He reflects on being the odd one out and the couples sing about togetherness with Side by Side by Side, which I almost made copyright infringement.
Whoop, 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 whoop.
And they celebrate their friendship with him in What Would We Do Without You? Although the answer is just what you usually do. Robert ends up without a dancing partner.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Get yourself some more single friends. In his apartment, he and April move to the bedroom.
Ooh.
She tells a story about a cocoon left in her care by a male friend. When the butterfly emerged, her cat injured it, and that ended the relationship.
Oh, dear. Mm. I'm actually surprised the cat only injured it, to be honest. I've met some cats.
Mm.
Anyway, carry on.
Robert struggles with what to say next, because it is a bit of a non sequitur. She just brings this up.
Yeah, okay, fair.
So he describes becoming lost and unable to locate the motel where a date eagerly waited for his return.
Right.
Mm.
Okay.
Unusual.
Yeah.
April undresses, feeling sorry for the misplaced girl and trying to grasp how his story relates to hers.
Look, yes, I'm with her on that. Mm. Oh, yeah.
They sing about her next flight with the song Barcelona, mm-hmm. and he urges her to stay, and when she agrees, he's shocked.
Good shocked? Bad shocked?
Probably shocked, bad shocked.
Bad shocked, okay.
He probably put it out there not really thinking she would take him up.
Yes.
Robert and Marta are guests at Peter and Susan's, who are now divorced but still live together. Marta says their relationship is very New York.
Yes, very modern.
Mm-hmm. At a nightclub, Robert and Joanne drink while Larry is dancing. Everybody has had way too much to drink when the scene opens.
Okay.
She loudly objects to the women staring at her drunkenness. Then proposes a sardonic toast to herself and the ladies who lunch, a famous song. She propositions Robert, but he turns her down. He anxiously sings about finding himself alone and uninvolved. He finally admits that he wants a meaningful relationship in Being Alive, which is the big, big song from the show. Interestingly, he has sung Being Alive. He wants to feel alive. He wants that person that everybody wants.
Yeah.
And not everybody gets, unfortunately.
This is true.
Back at the birthday party, the couples wait for Robert to arrive, but he fails to appear. His friends leave, shouting, "Happy birthday, Robert!" And alone on stage, he blows out the candles and smiles.
Poignant and moving. Interesting.
One of the directors I spoke about earlier who was on that chat for the 90th birthday celebrations, yeah. When asked what was his first association with the show company, he said that he grew up in Queens, a borough of New York.
Yes.
And for his birthday each year, he'd be taken by a family member to see a Broadway show. And they were going to see something really great, family-friendly.
Right.
Maybe okay. Oklahoma Revival, something like that.
Yeah, okay.
And he was going with his grandma. And then their ticket broker, which is an interesting thing, called to say that those tickets were not forthcoming.
Right.
And there's a new show that's just opened, which is really family-friendly, called Company. Grandma and a 10-year-old boy.
Oh, a 10-year-old, oh, my gosh.
And Grandma presumably was born at the turn of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
With 1915 sensibilities.
Oh, God. I hope they got a new ticket broker after that. That's ridiculous.
But that's when he fell in love with musicals.
Wow. Mm.
So he had been every year. That's the family tradition. But seeing this, and I think because it was a concept.
Yes, sure.
It's not any of the shows that he had heard on the albums that his parents had, because they would have had all the Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe and all of those things. And this one, he went, oh, you can do that in a musical. And switched him on to musicals, but also to being a part of it. So whether he decided he wanted to be a director or a writer or whatever it was at that stage of life,
sure.
That's when he went, yeah.
That's for me.
So weird notion. But worked out well.
Very weird notion.
And then he got to, by the time he was 50, he actually was directing a Broadway production of that company. Show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marvellous. It is said, I'm not sure on the truth because I haven't heard it come from Elaine Stritch's mouth, but when she first sang The Ladies Who Lunch, she was so commanding that in the bit where she says, "Everybody rise!" Everybody rise, rise! And she points to the audience. People stood up.
That's fabulous.
And in a little known movie, which I think is just called Camp, which is about being at Broadway camp, Anna Kendrick, as a very small teenager, in the camp version of Company, played Joanne. She's like a tiny 14-year-old. And she is also as commanding with the rise.
Yeah.
And in a kind of scary, possessed child kind of way.
Sure, it's totally hilarious. Sure.
Get into that one. It'll be somewhere on a Netflix or Paramount or somewhere.
Yeah.
Good fun for a Broadway kid to watch.
Today we have a very special guest with us, Rodney Havarton, who has come to speak to us as a big fan and expert, perhaps, on Company the Musical. He's giving me eyebrows to suggest he's not sure with the term expert.
Expert. Fan, I'll go with.
Great. All right, we'll settle on that. Yeah. Big fan of Company the Musical, which is obviously what we're talking about today. So, Rodney, thank you for coming and speaking to us today.
My pleasure.
It's air conditioned in here.
Beautiful.
Which is lovely.
Because it's an oven outside for those listening at home.
It certainly is. Great. Tell us about when you first came across the show Company.
Well, it was a bit of a discovery, really. I did a show called Little Night Music in 1996, which is another Sondheim show. Has the very famous song Sending the Clowns in it.
Yep.
Quite like that show. That was a great, fun show. And then a couple of years later, I did Sweeney Todd. Absolutely loved that. And I thought, gee, this Sondheim guy is pretty good. And a couple of years after that, there was a big store that opened in Adelaide called Borders. And it had a massive CD collection of Broadway cast recordings, and which is so unusual even back then.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is all right. And then I saw Company. And I remember hearing about this show, and a lot of the people in Sweeney said Company was a great show and I should have a listen to it. So this was like a reissue of the original cast album.
Okay.
So I got that and I listened to it and I thought, I really love the songs on this. I really love the quirkiness of them. I love the difference in styles. I love the humour. And then being a man in his mid-20s who was single and thought he was going to spend his whole life with cats and nobody else.
Not the musical.
Not the musical. Well, both, really. But I thought to myself, oh, this will be, you know, this is a song that really resonates. This is Being Alive. And I listened to that and I went, oh, yeah, I love this song. And then I just played that thing on endless loop. And I actually didn't care about the show, what was in the show.
Yes.
It was really the songs that got me into it. And it wasn't until a number of years later when Neil Patrick Harris did a concert performance with the New York Philharmonic and had his absolute dream cast on stage doing the whole show that I pieced together everything. And I was like, oh, I get how this all sort of, the jigsaw the story, pieces fit together. Yeah. For want of that. So that's how I got into it there.
Fantastic. Would you say Company is your favourite musical show?
It's not even my favourite Sondheim show. If I was ranking Sondheim shows, it would probably be third behind Assassins, which is both my favourite Sondheim and my favourite musical.
Right.
And then Sweeney Todd. In terms of overall musical, I would say it would be in the top 10. Yeah. Somewhere in there. Yeah, definitely.
That's not a bad ranking.
No.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a production of Company?
Well, I've conducted it. Does that count?
Yes, that counts. Yes. It involves getting in and up to your eyebrows.
It
so
really
absolutely
does.
It counts.
It's absolutely. Yeah, I have. It was 2.5 years ago. We weren't actually going to do Company. The interesting thing was I was at that point living in Kadena in rural South Australia, and I was about due to take long service leave from where I was working, and the director rang me up and said, I'm doing this show, would you like to MD? And I thought, well, this would be a good chance to do something where I don't have to rush back the next day. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours to get back there from Adelaide.
Sure.
Three times a week would just be insane. So I took my long service leave, but as we were auditioning, it became obvious that we needed to change the show. And then Company came up and I said, oh, yeah, we have to do Company. Let's do Company. It hadn't been done for, I think, 10 or so years in Adelaide.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so I was like, oh, this is like all the little slots falling into place.
Yeah.
What we also found out was, of course, at that point, a lot of the other productions had cast. So we knew that we weren't going to be dealing with a lot of people that would have multiple commitments.
Yeah,
and we also knew sort of who were the really great performers who were taking an air quotes breather. And we thought, we're actually going to get some really solid people auditioning for this show. And we did. We got a great cast for that show. So,
So if you were in the show, what would your dream role be?
I don't actually know if I could do a role at this point in time. Funnily enough, I nearly wound up playing Paul in that production because we didn't have a Paul. Yeah, try and think of a musical director being on stage.
Okay.
No, it was...
I've done that.
It was... It might work for some shows. I'm not sure it works for Sondheim. And quite rightly, we thought... As much as I was like, oh, this would be awesome to be in the role. And then I thought... I don't think it's going to work. I think, you know, and then eventually we found someone else that would play a point. And they did, of course, Brian. It was totally the right decision not to put me on stage. But in terms of, if it came up and said, would I audition? No, I don't think I would. I think I'm either too old for most of the male roles, and I'm probably a little bit too young for Larry, which is Joanne's husband.
Right.
Give it 10 years, I might consider Larry. But honestly, I think I had the best seat in the house conducting it, putting it all together, to use another Sondheim pun.
We didn't breach copyright.
No, we didn't.
No.
Did I sing it? No, I did not. Yeah, so I think I had the best, that was the best role, I think, for me. And I loved every second of that.
Fabulous. Do you have a favourite character?
I like a lot of them. I think my favourite couple... Sarah and Harry, and they're the ones that sing the little things you do together, and they wrestle with each other, and they try and, this is right near the start of the show, and I just love the snark and the sort of the way they bite at each other, but you know deep down they absolutely love each other. They will go to the ends of the earth for one another. In that, Neil Patrick Harris, it's played by former Goonie Martha Plimpton and Stephen Colbert. They do it so fabulously.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think that scene is quite funny because Bobby is just sitting there going, where is this all coming from? You know, and they're just trying to point out each other's flaws. And I don't know. Just something about that relationship that's quite funny. And I think, like all the couples in the show, you know a couple like that.
Sure.
You know, or you can identify your own coupling within it. And I think that's part of that broad appeal of the show. But those two are definitely my favourites there.
Brilliant. Brilliant stuff. So what's your, well, you've already sort of talked about it, but what's your favourite song in the show? And is it because of its place in the show? Mm. Now that, obviously, when you'd heard the cast recording, you'd made your decision. But now you've seen the whole show. Have you changed? Is it a different favourite song? And is it because of where it is in the show and the story it tells or the musicality? Or
I have a couple. I mean, Being Alive is obviously the song that really drew me into it. Yeah, and sure. It is still a favourite of mine. But, gosh, Another 100 People, My Martyr. The background to how that song came into being is fabulous. And I love that song because it's not about a relationship with a man. It's about a relationship with the city of New York. And I also love Not Getting Married Today. It's like a Gilbert and Sullivan patter, but better.
Yes.
It's better written. It just works, flows off the tongue a lot better.
Yeah.
I say this with all due respect to W.S. Gilbert, but, you know, those two songs I really love as well. And The Ladies Who Lunch is hilarious. It's great fun.
Great stuff. So it's a concept, company's a concept musical. Do you think that works? Would there be a way to tell it in a more linear way? Are there other shows that are more linear that you perhaps think could be chopped up in a more concept-y sort of fashion?
Might make them more. I don't know. I think it works. Company works because that was the idea right from the beginning.
Sure.
It can be a bit frightening for audiences that might read up on it and they hear, oh, it's a show with no plot or whatever. I used to say to people, think of it like a series of sketches.
Right.
That's got a sort of this thin connective tissue. Yeah. Is it a plot per se? Not really.
Yeah.
It's more of just a series of vignettes about relationships within the city of New York, all centered on this person, Bobby. And I don't think it would actually work taking it out of New York because it's such – New York itself is a character. Like I said, Another 100 People is a song about New York.
Right.
It's mentioned, it's referenced. The way people live is very New York in there. You couldn't have Company set in, say, Toowoomba. It wouldn't quite work. You could take the characters.
Yes, but absolutely.
I don't think the show would work outside of that New York setting. I think it would struggle, I think.
Yeah, okay, interesting. So if you were to cast it with people from any generation, living dead, et cetera, et cetera, who would you put into those key roles?
Oh, gosh. You know, I did think about this for quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
One of the things I've really loved is that in the past, with the exception of maybe one or two, they've really avoided sort of star casting.
Right, yeah.
Patti LuPone is an obvious exception to that, but because she does Joanne, because it's basically just Patti LuPone, it's, you know, they've really avoided a lot of that star casting. I think, you know, the notes I sort of made myself was I thought Sutton Foster in her younger years would have been an excellent Amy or Martha. I think she would have pulled that off. Not saying she couldn't do it today, but she's probably a little bit older for those roles. Sure. I don't know about you, but I really want to hear Ethel Merman singing The Ladies Who Lunch.
Rise, here's to the ladies.
Anyway, that to me would be priceless.
Yes.
I couldn't think of a sort of a celebrity Bobby, but there's probably some young bucks going around that could do it really well. Jeremy Jordan, I guess, is one that he seems to pop up everywhere. There's a few, I'm sure, and I'm sure that they would find them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they would, I mean, yeah, the last production had a female Bobby. They sort of gender swapped a few roles.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I that's about the best I could do.
No, that's good.
I think one of the joys is finding the people that can do it, and you go, oh, and they don't bring a lot of baggage with them, you know.
Yeah,
And that's a thing. And that's happened right from the original production as well.
Yeah. Okay, fabulous. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Rodney is going to reveal the next show, Behind the Door.
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz!
We're off to see the wizard.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Rodney.
That's okay.
Look forward to that.
Now, Jane.
Yes, Jane.
Now, for the listener, I'm Jane Feast, and I'm talking to Jane Suter, if we've made that clear today. And I am sad to say that Jane Suter is going to be leaving us.
Yes, I'm sad too.
As much as she enjoys this, being here, it's quite a big commitment. Yeah.
It is a big commitment.
You don't quite realise how much is involved in 45 minutes of content.
No, I thought I could talk for 45 minutes. No problem. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, no.
No, because we are of one mind that we actually want to bring you a quality product where we have at least read about, if not listened to, or watched the musical.
Correct.
Not just and me rave on. So... and it just does not fit in with the rest of Jane's life at the moment.
Correct.
So we have loved having you here. I'm using the royal we. That's only
me. We have loved being here.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Thank you very much, in all honesty. And I'm sure our listeners will be more than standing to ovation in their lounge room or in the middle of the park or wherever they are today, thanking you. And you might pop in as a guest one time when we actually do the show that you've seen.
Well, that would be fabulous. I would love to come back and do that and be a guest. It's been wonderful. And as you said, I've really loved this. It is a big commitment and it's one that I can't continue to make. But I have loved it, and I want to thank you very much, Other Jane, for inviting me to participate in this concept that you've had, and to give it that initial little kick off the ground. I'm sure that whoever comes in as the co-host in my stead will be wonderful. Maybe they'll even know something about musicals, which would be such an exciting change for you and the listeners. But thank you very much. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.
This has been another episode of Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast brought to you by the Gawler Broadcasting Association on Kaurna land in South Australia. Bye.
Bye.